Okay. So yesterday evening, we observed that when we try to describe our experience, we often, or at least sometimes, slide from the experience itself toward the verbalization of satellite emotions. Why? Because when we try to observe the experience itself, we don't know what to look at. Usually, we don't know exactly what to look at. Usually, we don't know which dimensions we should direct our attention towards. The difficulty is rather like that facing a biologist who is still a novice. It's not enough for him to have a high quality microscope if he doesn't know how to use it. In fact, without training and in the absence of detailed theoretical knowledge, he doesn't know what to look for, and he's just unable to recognize what he has in front of his eyes. Scientific observation with the microscope is a skill that has to be learned. The same applies to the observation of subjective experience, lived experience. Without training, we are in a sense blind. We just don't know what is there. This is very surprising, because as my lived experience is the most personal and intimate thing about me, I think I'm familiar with it, and cannot imagine for a moment that any particular inner effort should be necessary to become aware of it. However, if I asked you to describe precisely how you proceed in memorizing, for example, the content of an article, or how you proceed in writing an article, it's very likely that in a first stage, you would give quite poor descriptions. As researchers, all of us know how to carry out such tasks, but we have only a very partial awareness of the way we proceed. The main reason for this lack of awareness is that our attention is almost completely absorbed in the content, the what of our activity, to the detriment of the how. For example, while writing an article, we are completely absorbed in the content of the idea we are trying to express, but we are hardly aware of the contact our fingers on the pen or the computer keys, of the tensions of our back, of the rapid succession of inner images, slight emotions and felt meanings, rapid evaluations which accompany our activity of writing. We experience them, but in a pre-reflexive way, that is, without reflexive consciousness of them. So this diagram is a very simple. It represents our experience as a succession of internal operations, sensations, and inner states, and thus shows that our level of consciousness is high. And I call pre-reflexive experience this part of our experience which is lived, but not immediately accessible to consciousness, or introspection, or verbal report. This part of experience that needs a special training to be accessed and described. But I'm not sure you're already convinced of this, the existence of this reflexive part, and I'm going to propose you to invite you to some exercises in order to identify to become aware of the existence of this part. So To become aware of this reflexive part, we need to divert our attention from the content, the what of our experience, towards the how. This redirection of attention is sometimes triggered by an obstacle or a failure. It may also be the result of training. It may also be triggered by specific questions in the context of an interview. This redirection of attention is, in fact, precisely what Husserl calls the phenomenological conversion, which consists of diverting attention from the objects which appear to consciousness towards the subjective modes of appearance of these objects. Let's take an example. Jack, would you mind to carrying out a small task?
Sure.
Thank you. Could you spell the word elephant?
E-L-E-P-H-A-N-T.
Okay. Thank you, Jack. So you succeeded in achieving this task. Thank you. Now, I would like you to describe the way you went out carrying out this task. What happened when I asked you to spell the word elephant? Just after that, what happened to you?
Well, there was a moment of concern. I thought, I'm pretty sure I know how to spell it, but what if I don't? Mm-hmm. So there was a moment of concern.
Okay, a moment of concern.
Mm-hmm.
And after that?
It's interesting. It seems to me the letters just came out one after the other. I was relying on some... Well, I won't try to explain. The letters just came out, one after the other.
Okay, and how did they come out? Where? Was it something visual or auditory or something else?
There was nothing until I said them. The saying of them seemed to be the entire experience. But I did have a sense that I was drawing on something. There was a kind of a, it was like I had hit the right key and something was happening automatically.
Okay. So you just say the, that there was, could you come back to the, to the, this experience just and verify?
If I think about it again?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I stand by my description, yes.
Okay, so how did you say, I'm sorry, because it's difficult to me to reformulate in English.
In English, I understand. I said the letters just came out automatically, as though I was tapping, I touched the right key, is what I said. And then they just came out.
And what is... to touch the right key. How do you touch the right key? What does it mean? What do you do for touching the right key?
I don't know. There wasn't. That's a kind of backward description. It wasn't as though I had to reach out to touch the right key, but once I was spelling the word, once the letters were coming out. My sense was that I was tapped in to a database. That's not really, it didn't feel like a database, but I was tapped into some pool of what I know.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jack. Thank you. I would like to, did somebody else had a different experience? Yes, Michel.
Yes, I had a different, very different experience, and I was pretty sure that Jack would have had such type of very direct experience of rightness, just because my own spelling was much slower than his. I was, because I was seeing the words, and examining and thinking about how to tell them in English, because you know, P becomes P and so on. So it was very slow, and it was completely this way.
So you saw the word.
I saw the word.
Excuse me. I just interviewed Michel.
I'm sorry.
You saw, and where did you saw it?
Where?
See it? Where was it?
Just in front of me. In the air.
In the air. At what distance it was?
Close. Maybe this distance.
Okay, this distance about 10 centimeters. And how big was the word?
Quite big. So this big, approximately. Very big word.
10 centimeters.
And even written in script.
In script?
Without capital E. Just like that.
Okay. And which color?
It was pale pink. Maybe it was an association to pink elephants, but I didn't think of that.
And you could speak, and was there a background?
Yes, it was also pale background. A little bit. I can't see it quite clearly. Maybe a little bit clearer.
Okay. And did all the letters appear together, or one after the other?
No. Okay. They appeared by pieces. Mainly, three letters, and then I was turning, and so out of three letters, and so.
Okay.
So it was a little bit.
Successively by group of three. Yeah. So, and while looking at these letters, three by group of three, what happens? What do you do?
When I see them?
Yes, in fact.
It was an effort. It was an effort to try to project that you were in front of me Yes, a total effort. First to project it, then to manage to spell it in English.
Okay. So let's come back to the beginning. Let's come back to the first group of three letters. What do you do? So you see them appear, and what do you do at this moment?
Yes, I recognize them and we start to spell it then in French, then say, oh no, that's not right, and spell them in English then.
Okay, so you spell it you hear it. How does it work? You spell it when you say I spell it. How is it? What do you do?
Yes, I think I hear myself pronouncing the letter.
Okay.
The name of the letter.
You hear, you pronounce.
As if myself was emitting the sound without hearing.
Okay. So you don't hear yourself, or do you hear yourself internally? Do you?
Yes, maybe, but it's a sort of hearing which is not like. If I hear somebody else speaking, but just as if I feel that going out from my throat, it's a type of hearing.
Okay.
In the moment.
Okay. It's.
Okay. Can I just ask my question? Sorry to have interrupted you. I just wondered if Michelle. I just wondered if you, when you saw the letters, did the E's have accents?
No. Okay. No, they didn't. But because clearly, it's interesting because that means that I indeed wrote them in English.
So you see the letters appear, and you say them with your voice, internally with your voice, but very silently. You don't really hear your voice.
Mm-hmm.
Like something.
I feel myself trying to articulate the letters.
Okay, trying to articulate. So. First, in French, and you said just before that you are trying to translate in English. So you said the letters in French and then in English, or how does it work?
It's rather that I felt myself starting in French, and there was a sort of repression, and that's the case, and
okay.
And I came back another time and say, oh. It's E, not E.
Okay. So we are going to stop there because we could go further, this exercise was just I wanted, in fact, to help you both to turn your attention away from the word being spelled, from the content, toward the how of spelling. And I wanted to help you maybe describing a set of visual and auditory almost kinesthetic sensations that would have probably stayed really reflexive if this question had not been asked. So it's the goal of this small demonstration is just to show you this dimension, pre-reflective dimension of actions and sensation we live, but without being fully conscious of them. I have to say that, Jack, your way of spelling is special. compared with the lot of experience of spelling that I collected,
right.
it's very instantaneous. So I wonder if it's just because the vision, the image is so the image of anything you do for spelling the mm-hmm. is so rapid,
mm-hmm.
or something else.
When I was listening to Michelle, I thought, well, maybe there was a word before. You know, it's possible, but I was actually reminded in my own description. I don't know if this is helpful, but. You know, we have in America, we have this National Spelling Bee, which is a big contest every year, and it's become quite popular. And if you watch these children, they've trained so much that it always seems automatic. You know, someone asks them to spell a word, and they say the word, and then they spell it. And it seems as though, you know, I felt that my description kind of matched my visual image of how they do it. And when I was young, just as a little boy, I used to drill on spelling. I was proud of being able to spell well. So I don't know if any of those things were relevant.
Mm.
It's interesting to me that it's unusual. That I can see that this. Yeah.
Mm. Did somebody have a very different experience? Or?
Not really. What I noticed more so than last night was a very, very strong tendency to default to explanation rather than describing the experience.
Mm-hmm.
Like when Jack was talking about tapping the right key, I was immediately interpreting that into, well, accessing memory. And so I would have gone into that line of description and explanation rather than description, saying, well, I felt I was accessing a memory, which wasn't actually the experience at all, but that would be my attempt to embellish it. And I noticed that very strong tendency to default to explanation when I didn't have clarity about the experience in ways that I could describe it. And then, of course, I noticed as this conversation was happening sort of thinking that, well, of course, we are not aware of the how, because if we were to pay attention to the how, we'd be tripping over ourselves. How do I walk? How do I talk? If we try to pay attention to the how, it kind of gets in the way of the content. So I was going in that direction. Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's an interesting question. Can we pay attention to the how and to the what and to the how at the same time?
That's another question. Well, Jack's, there was saying this nothingness and then the words pop out. So should we interpret that as there's a fundamental level of the experience that we can't go deeper? So, or could it be that just in this case we didn't ask the right kind of questions for him to relive more subtle structural level that was actually going on? Or is there a point where we just say, okay, that's it, we can't go any deeper?
Je suis désolée, je comprends pas bien.
Bon, en fait, il a dit, c'est que puisque Jack, en fait, a dit que ça venait si spontanément que véritablement il ne peut pas dire comment ça venait, sauf à indiquer que c'était juste une clé qui pressait, est-ce qu'on doit s'arrêter là dans l'interview ou essayer de le presser plus avant pour lui faire creuser comment était cette expérience infinitésimale de surgissement des lettres? Est-ce qu'on peut en toi aller plus profondément en le prêtant à un explicitation.
I think if I was alone with Jack, if I could ask some questions and if it was a real explicitation session, I would like to ask him other questions. I don't know which questions exactly, but I think.
So you could go deeper.
Deeper, I don't know. I'm not sure it's deeper. My impression is just that Jack says it's automatic. There is nothing, just. But in fact, a lot of people say that. Because they just are not aware of the rapid operations that unfold. But I'm not sure that it's the case with Jack. Maybe not. I'm not sure of that. But if I had time, I would like to ask him questions and to try to make him slow this process. Maybe with all other little experiences, and
just to give us a sense of what you're talking about, as you speak to us, as you've just been doing, for most of us that does appear just automatic. So it'd be really interesting to know from you whether you've explored any of that to see whether what kind of things maybe are accessible to awareness. Thinking is just one version. That's within psychology we call it inner speech, and it really has the similar characteristics to overt speech. So I would say, as I'm speaking to you, exactly what Jack said. It's different from spelling because I don't have to think. It really is automatic, if you like. And I really don't know what it's classic what you said, that I really don't know exactly what I'm going to say until I've actually said it. So I'm about as close to it as you are. Mm-hmm. But it's intriguing to me that you might, by your technique, indeed take things back a bit.
Yeah.
Can you? And if you have, just one or two examples of the sorts of things that one might access that we wouldn't normally access.
We are going to make an exercise. It's the subject of our session.
Yeah.
But I think when we speak, I have explored this, the way words emerge. I have explored this experience with these interview techniques.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's not so automatic that it looks like. It's easier to explore when writing because it's slower. Writing is slower, and but it seems that we rely on something proverb, some what Jungian calls felt meanings, felt meanings. He has written a lot of things about that, which are very interesting. And I just verified that when I want to say something, to communicate something, I have to relate in myself to something special, to a meaning which is in myself, embodied somewhere. And when I reach this meaning, I make gestures, for example. We can see, you can see, you feel very well when a person is in contact with this internal thing. I don't want to, I have no word for that. For gentle, it is the felt meaning. But you can see, you can feel when a person is in contact with that, or just making sounds with his mouth. It's very different.
Mm.
And when you turn your attention inside where this dimension, it becomes more and more vivid. You can really observe it. It's not really observe, but we can, you can get more and more into contact with it and feel it. I think it's a sort of training. But apparently, it's so automatic, and everybody thinks it's very automatic, but because it's very, very rapid. But there is ways to slower this process and observe it. But I don't like this term of observe, because it's not observe, it's touching. More touching it or feeling it.
Yeah.
Or
just briefly on that, a good practice for developing that degree of noticing or awareness is Bohmian dialogue. David Bohm's motive of dialogue.
I don't know that.
Very useful. Okay. Yeah.
Can you explain to us? I would like to address,
yeah,
but afterwards. Yes, thank you.
Observing, maybe rather than touching it, getting in touch with it.
Yeah, getting in touch.
Yeah,
yeah,
which
yes.
is. Yeah.
Yes, it's
contact.
Thank you.
Coming into contact with it.
Coming into contact,
yeah.
Contacting,
yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
Or tasting it.
This might be a little fussy, but I was surprised when you asked, say, Michelle or others, say, what was your experience? Because you hadn't asked us to spell elephant. So I probably in this case it didn't make much difference, because a lot of people probably just pretended that they had been asked to spell elephant, or tried to spell elephant even though they hadn't been asked. And maybe those experiences are very similar to the experiences they would have had if you had asked them. But I guess if we wanted to be try to be objective about this, we would not assume that it's the experience of spelling, of doing something, is the same when Jack might have had extra constraints of having to comply publicly with the request that might alter his experience in some way. But in spelling, okay, probably not. But I just thought, if you would say, okay, everybody, I want you to spell elephant in your mind or something. We couldn't all do it aloud because that would be confusing, but spell elephant in your mind or something. And then you could ask Jack, now how was it for you? And then you would have reason to believe that his experience might there's a basis at least for trying to compare his experience to other people's experience. But prima facie, you have at least a potential very different experience of somebody actually spelling elephant and other people pretending as if they've been asked to and doing it covertly in their mind rather than aloud. So there are all kinds of reasons there why you might expect
it. You're right. It's a mistake.
I didn't mean to say it was a mistake.
Yes, it is. It is, but usually I propose to somebody in particular, and most of people do it.
Well, they don't do the same thing, because they would have to say it aloud in order to do the same thing. And saying elephant, E-L, is very different experientially from just going...
Yes, you're right.
But perhaps that's
they do it in inside them. Yes, mm-hmm.
Yes, you're right. So perhaps that's why Jack, who was, I was very proud when I was young, so I used to pass spelling tests without a problem. Mm-hmm. And elephant isn't a difficult word. But perhaps that's why, because you were doing it publicly, you had that moment of thinking, oh, what if I don't get this right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't have that at all. And I had the same experience almost, as I said, it wasn't pink, it was the white letters, it was just there, it just was there. So there's no anxiety about it. But maybe to do it publicly, I would think, oh, mm-hmm.
Oh, you just got less neuroses than I have, because I have that moment of anxiety, even though I was doing it internally.
Somebody found out.
I will say, as we might use different experiential strategies, depending on whether we're doing it covertly or... let me give a concrete example. So if you're saying it aloud, you can use the echoic buffer, the current memory of the sound of your voice to prompt you for the next letter. Whereas when you're doing it covertly, you don't have, unless you have very good auditory imagery, you'll have to rely on something else. So you'll either have to be very good at generating covert auditory imagery, which a lot of people aren't good at, or you'll have to use the letter instead. It's something visual.
It must be verified. I don't know. Maybe.
Let me just say, though, that I think that did actually, the fact that I was performing did have something to do with with the way my experience came out. I mean, if I had just been one of the audience, this is obviously a guess, but based on my reaction to how Michelle said it, I might have had an experience more like his. But with the performing, there was this sense of going on automatic that somehow had to do with the fact that I was performing.
Okay. Thank you. So the exploration of this pre-reflexive part of experience shows that it has two distinct dimensions. In fact, I don't expect you to me croire sur parole, to believe me, just but to verify it in, but it's the result of the exploration I have achieved through interviews. So two dimensions, a temporal or diachronic dimension and a non-temporal or synchronic dimension. Thus, an explicitation interview consists of gathering descriptions of these two dimensions. A very important point, which is the kingpin of this method, is that in both cases, the questions don't concern the content of experience, but the structure of experience. In fact, not the words, but the power of experience. And in a first step, let's examine the diachronic dimension. The diachronic dimension of an experience corresponds to its unfolding in time. It is the succession of operations, perceptions, and inner states that occur in a given situation. I call it the diachronic structure because it is more or less the same in a given situation for a given person. It is more or less the same and independently from the content. For example, spelling a word, memorizing something, or any type of action, or even for experience in general that we describe, we observed that there is a common structure independent of the content.
Is that a question? Are you saying independent structure for each person? So would there be individual differences, or just for human beings generally?
No. There are a lot of difference from one person to another. Sometimes not. but it is the structure which may be compared from one experience to another one for the same person, and from a person to another one. It is the structure that we can compare.
But if I'm remembering, say, a painting, and I'm remembering a poem, so now I've got two different contents. It would seem to me that the contents themselves would influence the way I would go about remembering them. But are you saying that's not correct?
I say that probably we'll find some a common way that is particular to you to memorize.
Morphologies. Do some kind of morphological correspondences between the different processes, perhaps.
Yes, I don't know what you mean by morphological, but...
The form, there's a certain similarity of form to the structure of both appreciating a poem or appreciating a painting. They may not be identical, but there'd be some pattern similarities.
Yeah, okay. I take an example. It's the goal of the session. So, to collect the diachronic dimension, diachronic structure, let's say just for the moment, that is the unfolding in time, the succession of operation and states and perception and in time. And an experience can be described as a succession of phases, and then of sub-phases, and then and so on, and at different levels of detail of or granular, or I'm sorry, difficult for me.
Granularity,
which are increasingly precise. I'll give you an example just right now. So to collect the diachronic description of an experience in this way, the interviewer asks questions which guide the interviewee's attention towards the various moments of his experience, which flag or signal them without suggesting any content. It is a content, we say it's a content-empty questioning, which enables the researcher to obtain a precise description without infiltrating his own presuppositions. And it's very simple questions. The interviewer marks the start. How did you start? What happened first? And then he marks the next stage. What did you then? And after a lot of questions, he marks the end. What happened at the end? What did you end with? So this type of questions enable the gathering of an initial level of description in the form of a succession of stages, of big stages. And the same type of questioning is resumed to deepen the description of a stage. So, for example, can you look at step number two again? How did you do this? How did you start? So as to obtain a description of a succession of operations. And so on for each level, with this technique, we can go deeper and deeper with very simple questions. How did you start? And then when the person has said something, described the starting, the best way is to reformulate it. So you start this way, and just after that, what did you do? And okay, you did that and that, and just after that, what did you do? And let's take step two. How did you? Let's return to step two. How did you start this thing? And how did you end? It supposes that there is a start.
Mm-hmm.
And the end. So it's. I'll come back to this point later. But before, I would like to take an example. My question.
Um.
a question which is very important. No, I'll come back to that later. Let's go to the example. It's a task consisting of memorizing a matrix of figures.
Well, monkeys are much better at this than we are.
What?
Chimpanzees are much better at this than humans are. Little.
Only if they haven't got very much else to do in their lives.
Only with single digits.
Up to, yeah.
Anyway, you can ignore that.
Right. Only very sad monkeys.
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe the next
question. I'll give you a very simplified excerpt of an interview between two students of mine. Which describes the mental operation carried out to memorize the matrix down to the finest level of detail possible. So, a first set of questions. When I give you the matrix to memorize, what do you do? How do you begin? And then afterwards, etc., etc. Enabled the one of the students, the interviewer, to gather a first level of description in the form of a four-step sequence. I read the whole matrix. I memorize the first line. I memorize the second line. I memorize the last line. So the interviewer chose to deepen the second stage. I memorize the first line. And what do you do to memorize the first line? I read the three numbers, then I reread them mentally. So the question, what do you do to reread them mentally, enables to deepen in this form. I make a mental representation of the empty matrix. Then the numbers appear on it one by one, and so on. How do you make a representation of the empty matrix? I close my eyes. I see it. It's about 50 centimeters in front of me, slightly upwards to the right of my head. It has the same appearance as the matrix of the page, but about twice as large. So, how do the numbers appear to you on it one by one? It was the sentence just before. The boxes of the matrix are filled in one by one with the corresponding number. The number that is written is clear. When I move on to the next box, the number of the previous box remains written but becomes blurred. So, where is our the box? Yes. How are the box filled in? Because he said the box of the matrix are filled in one by one. How are the box filled in? I fill them in. I send the number to myself very quietly, and at the same time I put them into the matrix. So we could have gone deeper by questions such as how do you set the number to yourself very quietly, or what do you do to put the number on the matrix, etc., etc. So from the second or third level of description, for example, from this level of description, the pre-reflexive dimension of the memorization process is attained, because to deepen this type of description, It is the help of the interviewer becomes essential. For example, the question, at this level, I'm sorry, it's very tiny for me to speak, so.
Well, maybe I can just point out one example we had yesterday about the diachronic structure. When I interviewed Steve, what appeared was that there was actually at least two temporal scales going on. So there was a general shift from something a more contemplative experience to one that was more worldly situated, so like an outward movement of attention into the world. But within that general shift, there was a shift from your voice to what you were doing with your hand because you were clicking the mouse.
Mm-hmm.
So even with the more general change of, you know, from an internal experience and more awareness of the world, within that there was also a, you know, quicker shift of attention between your voice and the mouse. So there was two different scales going at the time.
So in fact there are some very important questions about the end. For example, in a task like this one, the question, how do you know that you have memorized the matrix? How do you know that you have memorized? This question helps the interviewee to become aware of very implicit tests that he does for tests for verifying that the matrix is memorized. And if the interviewee doesn't ask a test for that, probably is a strategy of memorization is not very good. So this type of question is very important. How do you know that you have finished? How do you know that you have succeeded in when the experience consists in achieving something, some action?
Could I use any measures, like in psychology they have things like self-efficacy, you know, how confident would you be if I were to ask you to like fill in that matrix now? People might vary, they might feel like I've done the best I can, but I don't think I've really, if I had 100 square matrix, I might feel that I would say I'll only get a few numbers. So do you have any interest or any effort to measure this? Because it's another kind of judgment people can make. Not only have they've memorized it, but now they'll have a judgment about how confident they are in their memory or something like that.
I'm afraid it's the same for me.
Do you ask them if they are confident that they have succeeded, and how confident?
How sure are you that you are right?
That's all.
Yes.
You feel, yes, I know.
Mm.
Or maybe,
yes,
I don't know.
Yes, it's a good question to ask. Yeah. And if the person say, "Yes, I'm very confident," how do you know that you know?
Are you confident about your confidence?
Yeah.
and do you in fact test them with this matrix to see if they know? Do you in fact say, "All right, now tell me what was in the matrix"? And are they right?
We'll see later.
Okay.
We'll see later.
Okay.
Can they memorize it? How do they know that they've done a particular operation in the memorization?
Yes. Please, can we? We are going to come back to this exercise later. Mm-hmm. So, I would like to go on. So that you can. Also use some questions as very it's
like to Ronnie Lang.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
In fact, Vermeersch adapted the questioning of the psychotherapist Milton Erickson, and he introduces in the interview some questions that when the person, a little like Jacques, says, "Oh, it just happens. It just happens." But no, because Jacques answered. But some people said just, "Oh, I don't know what happens. I don't know." And the question is, when you don't know, what do you know? Or I do nothing, because, for example, language is very automatic. I do nothing. It just, and when you do nothing, what do you do? And in fact, these questions are very powerful, because they help the interviewer to they encourage him to stabilize his attention on this experience too.
May I just say, you know, if you're a cop and you're interviewing a suspect, and you say to the suspect, "What were you doing at 8:15? And the suspect says, "I was doing nothing." And then the cop says, "What were you doing when you were doing nothing? What were you doing?" You're actually making the suspect feel more guilty, and maybe they really were doing nothing. Maybe they were innocent.
I'm not sure I understand these questions. So the first one, is it different from saying, "Are you sure?" That's how I would take it. If somebody said to me, well, I would take it sort of in the way Steve was saying, that somebody's basically not believing me at first pass, or doubting my answer, and then asking me to try again. Is that the meant? Is it doing something other than that? Or
it's not exactly that. It's just the effect of the question is different. If you say, can you verify that you do not think that, because it let's try an exercise.
Okay.
As an interviewer, you can try this question and see and feel what the result is.
I was thinking of it more from the interviewee side. I wouldn't know how to react to it other than it sounds a bit aggressive, like somebody saying, "Okay, you don't know, I don't really trust that you've answered me."
When you Rob, you said if somebody asked me the question, you know, how do you know you don't know?
Well, hang on.
I've been inclined to say, there's a kind of feeling.
That
would be the experiential result for me. I feel.
I have any problems with that question, because it doesn't imply that the first one is the one that is really just, it's basically like what Steve said. Well, that's how I interpret it.
When you do nothing,
I've already told you I do nothing, and now you're asking me what I do. do you want me to just repeat myself, or are you basically saying, could you just check again, or are you really sure you're doing nothing? That's fine. The last one is fine. How do you know you don't know? That's a pretty reasonable question. Well, because I tried to find the answer and I failed, so I'm assuming that I don't know. That's one way you can answer that question. But the first one, I don't know how to take it as an interviewee, other than the interviewer saying, "Are you sure?"
Well, the fact is that Erickson was the most successful therapist of all time, and he did this all the time.
Yeah.
So it's a paradoxical stuff.
No, I don't think it's the same, really. It's not just, "Are you sure?"
When you
do nothing, what do you do? That means that you are invited to go a little bit deeper and see whether this nothing contains something that you didn't notice.
Right, okay. For me, that's the same as saying, "Are you sure?" Because, in other words, well, you know, if you go a little deeper, maybe what seemed like nothing to you will turn out to be that there was something going on. Is that the case? That's what it would be like to me.
Think of it in the just as someone doing nothing. You're set to describing yourselves as doing nothing. When you say, "Well, what are you doing at the moment?" "Oh, I'm doing nothing." And then you say to them, "Well, how are you doing nothing? What are you doing when you're doing nothing?" And that's a reasonable question. You know, "Well, I'm just sitting, you know, staring into space, or I'm reading the newspaper, or I'm making myself a cup of tea. I'm not getting on with my work," or, you know, "These are the things I'm not doing." So there are lots of ways of interpreting in, if you like, the common sense world of real life. So it's
so
that kind of a similar. It's a similar. The way I'm interpreting it, the good way, is that there's a similar kind of invitation to try to articulate the way in which you're doing nothing.
Isn't it this idea that sometimes I sit and think, and sometimes I just sit? Yeah, and that's the kind of thing. Oh, please.
I think Claire's wanting to move on. I think that's a good idea, because we'll do exercises, right?
Yes, because, and I think we won't have the time to do exercise, because I would like you to test these questions, and then afterwards we discuss on the ground of this experience. Mm-hmm. Are you okay? Or do you... you have a question?
Basically, I was just going to say that, to me, a way to rephrase that first question would be, how do you do nothing?
Exactly. That's what I just said.
How do you do nothing that achieves the same purpose, I think?
Yes, it's another type of Erikson question. How do you do
that? No, it's not meant that way. In what way are you doing
that? Oh, I know it's meant in that other way, but it could be seen as just meant.
That's why, so you could rephrase it to in what way.
Tone of voice.
Right, so you could rephrase it to in what way are you doing nothing, and that way you avoid the judgmental part of it.
Yes.
I think that's a horrible question.
Really?
But I don't want to talk about it. Your question is a horrible question. Her question is a fine question.
So it could be that...
But I think we should get out of here and think specifically.
Two profiles of interview, just to show that we can... The first one stays very at the surface, at the very... un grossier and
gross level
of description. And in the second one, the interviewee and the interviewer are chosen to deepen the phase two and phase three, for example. Mm-hmm. It's every time it's a choice, because in an interview you cannot deepen all the phases. Mm-hmm. It's with this type of question you can go very very deep, and so. Mm-hmm. As time is, the time of the interview is limited, you have to choose what you want to deepen. The synchronic structure is the specific configuration of the experiential space of the subject at a given time, at a given moment. It's very much like a beep experience, a spot. At a given moment. So, for example, the interviewer asks question for helping the interviewer describe the structure of his experience at a given moment without inducing any content. For example, if the interviewee becomes conscious of a mental image, the researcher will bring him to precisely direct his attention to the structural characteristics of this mental image. So, in fact, I would like to invite you to participate in a small experiment. I'm sorry, Steve, because you have already done that. At Fresh's.
I've forgotten. You forgot.
And I think last year I proposed something like that. But so I propose you to take your time here and now to imagine a mountain waterfall. So you can close your eyes or not, as you want. And just make a sign to me when you have it. Is it okay?
Go forward.
Mm-hmm. Don't face with me.
Now I would like you to answer in your head the following questions. Did this waterfall appear in black or in colors? Black and white or in colors? Was this image clear or subtle? Was it stable or fleeting? Was it an imaginary waterfall or a waterfall that you had seen before? Was the visual scene accompanied by sounds, by smells, by bodily sensations? Did you see this image as if it was a photograph or a film, or were you inside the scene, in the location of the waterfall? Let's have a show of, and how many of you saw a photograph of all film?
Or a film. Which one?
A photograph or a film.
Oh, as opposed to an actual waterfall.
Yeah.
What's the question?
How did you see the waterfall as a photograph or a film outside you?
Oh,
yes. Or were you inside the scene?
It's different to saw a photograph or to be inside the scene near the waterfall. So how many saw a photograph or a film? Four of you, okay, Misha? No. So how many saw a scene? Where in the scene?
How many were in the scene? At the scene, rather than in the scene. It looks confusing because otherwise you might be in the waterfall. It means you were actually there as opposed to it being a picture of some sort. There was a real waterfall. You thought you were looking at an actual waterfall, not a picture of a waterfall. So you were at the scene of the waterfall.
This will be our subject tomorrow. That you can see the waterfall as a picture,
yeah.
Or you can imagine you are in the scene
in the
inside.
Waterfall.
No, in the scene.
You're there. The waterfall is here. You're in the scene with the waterfall.
Yeah, but there is. Yeah. Oh, you mean you see a picture?
Do you mean
being present, or do you mean that I say in my case I see an image of myself here and a waterfall in front of me? Is that what you're saying?
No, you're just being present. You're part of the scene.
Yeah, that's being at the waterfall.
Not inside the waterfall. You're at the place. We understand. It's fine. We know what you mean. It's like demonstrating. It's not like this. Okay. And Russ, I would have to say that I was not successful in seeing the waterfall.
No. There was something usual about my phenomenology, but I would say neither one lived in part of those things.
Okay. So now silently consider these questions. For those of you who saw a photo, where did you see it? At the bottom, at the top, at the bottom, to the right, to the left, where?
I answered yesterday's own question, but it's just because I saw a film recently that had a mountain waterfall scene, so I imagined that scene again, but I didn't imagine watching the film. I imagined the very same scene that I saw when I saw the film, so I'm not sure whether I should have said yes or no to your question, because I didn't imagine that I was in a cinema looking at a screen.
Yes.
So I can't say where the image...
You didn't imagine you were in your armchair in the...
But you just saw again the same image that I had, similar image that I had when I was...
But the question is where did you see it? Where? So you saw this...
Within your field of vision. Within your total field of vision. Is it on the left or the right or the top?
No, if you see an image or a film, where was it?
In front of you.
In front of there or there or in your head or where did you see it? Usually people answer very easily to this question. Where is it? But sometimes it's difficult to. But it's. And how far was this image? And how big was it? So
Maybe this is kind of the same vein, meaning that I was sitting here with pictures. When you said a waterfall, I kind of remembered waterfalls that I'd visited, and then And so I could see the water running as though it was looking at a window that I had just opened. And but I was still felt as though I was sitting here. So that could be like a film-like quality to it. Mm-hmm. It's not like I was suddenly in the forest. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the waterfall did not seem like it was a movie, but more like something that, and if it could have been this big, but because it was in my imagination anyways, in the far distance, like as though when I usually see it, it's it would be, you know, you don't get that close usually to.
Similar experience to you, actually. It was more like a tunnel vision, you know, opening up to a scene somewhere else. So it was a real waterfall present there, but it was like a tunnel vision onto it.
Mm.
So I wasn't actually in a forest, but it was a real waterfall.
Okay. Okay. In fact, I don't want to spend too much time to talk to this question.
Okay.
We could, but
I thought you might be interesting, but maybe it's dangerous also to ask this about the sounds and smells,
yes.
Bodily sensations.
Yes. Yes.
But I don't know whether it's because you'd asked if there were smells and sounds.
Mm-hmm.
Or whether you felt bodily sensations in that.
Yeah.
I
was trying not to get wet.
No.
Okay.
I want to go to to another exercise,
yeah.
Because
okay.
it's just to give a little concrete meaning to what I call the structure of an experience. Because the goal of these questions was to redirect our attention from the content of the visual experience, that is the mountain waterfall, that could have been an elephant or anything, which usually absorbs our attention, toward the synchronic structural characteristic of the experience, which are usually reflexive. For example, the dimensions of the image, the very fact that it is an image, or that you are in the scene, or that you a mix of the two possibilities, it is usually pre-reflexive, and the localization of the image in the space, your perceptual position outside or inside the image, the possible association of the image with sounds, bodily sensations, feelings, all this is correspond to the structure of the experience, independent of the content of the experience. You can find the same type of structure for many experiences. And it is this structure that then can be compared from one experience to another one. This is the structure. For the content is very difficult. It's quite impossible to compare content, but it's possible to compare structures. Yeah.
If I was to pay attention to what emotional quality accompanied the image, would you consider that a structural component or a content?
I would consider the fact that there is emotion. I would consider it as a part of the structure.
I think so. But
after that, we can refine and say there are different types of emotions, and maybe a certain type of emotion could belong to the content.
Yeah.
In fact, this distinction between content and structure is not so easy. I think it's a very it's very important to
to have a reflection about that.
Is the distinction inherently fluid, or is it that there is a definite distinction, but it's very difficult to recognize it?
It's not very difficult.
But do you think it is definite? How definite is it? Is it like that, or is it like sea and shore?
In fact, I'm in the process. This method is not finished one. We are in the process of exploring the difference of between structure of content, and sometimes it works very well.
Yeah.
And we are in the process of refining what is the structure of experience.
Yeah.
But it's not complete, and sometimes I'm not sure, and I have some questions. For example, is the structure in the experience, inside the experience?
Mm.
I think it's, and I have one, it's one question. Is the structure in the experience? Does it belong to the experience?
Mm.
For me, it's a question I have. No, I have an idea of the answer now, some idea, but this sort of questions, it's difficult, but I think it's very important to think about that, because it will become clear afterwards why it is so important.
There was a question I wanted to ask, which I think bears directly on that particular one. And it was triggered for me by your questions: how far away is it, and how big is it? When we were dealing with the waterfall, because I was thinking, well, are you asking how far away does the waterfall appear, or how far away does the image appear? And it's the same move that you introduced to us earlier from Husserl. I can ask, how far away is Claire? Or how far away does Claire appear to be? Or how far away does my image of, my perception of Claire, or it's easier with size, actually. How big does Claire seem to be to me? And how big is my visual experience of Claire, which is kind of bad up in. So in a way, one, the content, obviously, is in the case of the waterfall, is, well, one way of reading it anyway, is that you're asking about the waterfall, about it, the same way I could be asking about Claire, as opposed to my experience of the image itself, irrespective of where it is, or my experience of you, irrespective of what or where you are.
It's not too far.
Je pense que Max demandait simplement si quand tu poses la question, ta formulation est telle qu'on comprend on demande si la cascade est grande ou petite, ou est-ce que c'est notre perception de la cascade qui est grande ou petite.
Oh yes. In fact, my question are not clear enough, because the question was just in the case if you see an image, how big is the image? It's not the cascade. How big is this image?
And also the link between that question and this issue of content and structure.
Le lien entre cette question qu'il vient de poser sur quelle est la cascade qui est grande ou petite, est-ce que c'est la cascade perçue, la cascade effective, et la question du rapport entre la structure et le contenu. Est-ce qu'il y a un lien entre les deux?
Yes, there is a link, but I'm not sure I understand your question. But my question was about the size of the image. It was not of the. The question was not relevant for people who were in the scene as you were. Mm-hmm. So I.
No. Because in my case, I was in the scene, but nevertheless, I was a little bit outside the scene. It was as though the actual waterfall was there, a little bit to the left, and a little bit away from me. Although at a point, I actually was worried I was going to get, and this relates to, I had a worry that I was going to get, spattered with the water. So I was trying to keep my distance from it, but also I was keeping my distance from the image of the scene that I was, was a real waterfall. If that makes sense. I mean, it was contradictory, actually. Mm. It was a contradictory.
Okay.
Claire, let me ask, at some point we should probably take a short break. We're about halfway through the session. Is this a good time?
Halfway, yes. I've almost finished. So I would like to finish. No, I finished after the pause, but I would just say that the structure is what is independent of the content. So when the size of the image is independent of the content of the image, and that's all.
So we'll take a break for 15 minutes, 10 to 15 minutes, 15 minutes, outer edge.
It's tiring, yeah?
Well,
Manuel. Have a little discussion about this exercise. We can have discussion at two levels, the level of experience of memorizing and recalling and what is this experience, and the level of the experience of describing this experience, so the level of the interview, in fact. So. How we can begin with the first one?
Well, the most important thing, of course, is that Max gets his pudding, gets his desserts.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and so does Michelle.
Oh, okay. That's really important.
Oh, no, we were also successful 100%.
So you get your pudding.
Oh. No, not me. I was shared, but my interview got it 100%. So you say it's not important. Well, I would like to report it's impossible and humiliating.
Oh,
no problem.
Yes, on the content of the memorization or recalling process, does an interviewer want to synthesize the strategy of his interviewee?
No, I can start with Max's strategy was to begin by looking at the matrix and then chunking it line by line, horizontally, in threes, and to then and his eyes were, sorry, you asked me to observe him, so his eyes were closed while he was memorizing it, and blinking in rhythm. Probably, that kind of pace. Mm-hmm. And from my position, it looked like he was looking down to the right, underneath his eyelids, with his eyes closed. And then he would open his eyes and check back to see if he had memorized the first line. And then when he reached the level of confidence that he had, he would move to a chunk, a second chunk of three, and then to the third one. And
I would say that his awareness of that first task of memorizing the matrix was more clear, less vague than whatever strategy he employed in recalling what he had memorized. In fact, at the end of our interview, Max concluded that he couldn't really say too much about the strategies employed in recalling what he had memorized. So the same way? Yeah.
Yeah, according to the report of my interviewee, that the process was not like that. The body language also was different. I noticed no closed eyes or meditative position. It was just very fixed on the matrix. Visually, with very lively gestures, you know, standard, like lots of doing hand gestures, sort what could be interpreted as uneasiness or I don't even want to psycho or pseudo-psychologize, but just to report about the body language and this very stable and fixed eyes on the matrix. I didn't give any time, but just I was surprised after relatively, I don't know, less than 2 minutes, I didn't measure it. I just gave him enough time to decide when he's finished. He said, I'm okay. So he gave him, and what he reported was like that at the beginning. So it is obvious a transition from sort of more blurred or unstructured, composition of numbers toward searching sort of logic in it. Not the logic, so law-like or rule-like pattern. He found like a V form. Like V form in
Y
form. It was Y form, okay? Mm. And anyhow, it seemed then to stabilize more and more. Though in the moment when he gave his own the paper back and he decided he's finished, he said, I guess I'll forget it the moment I depart from it, so that also this in image would also dissolve, so to say. Fortunately, it was not the case, so it need not be. Well, he did repeat, he did test himself, not very, not in the way that I could. He was very, how would I say, concentrated or in any external way visible, that he was paying very a strong attention to it. However, it worked even in this, as he later described, not very concentrated matter, not loose, I cannot recall the exact words, and yet for me it was it can be efficient at stay, even if the, though it seems it was not so exactly, you know, in front of the eyes. Even in so sort of loose way, let's say, it could also be memorized in the correct way. His way of further was of, I asked for how he discriminated this matrix field, and he said one of the criteria is whether these are two-digit or one-digit numbers. So it was one of the criteria and the composition of it. Okay, I think this will be a short version, because I wasn't getting time.
Thank you. I think we cannot describe all the strategies because we have not time enough. I just like to know if there were auditory strategies. Yes, yours?
Steve has a kind of song incantation rhythm for memorizing. But when he recalls, he did a very specific gestural thing. And I didn't know how to draw on that for his, for helping him recall his recall. So I, without doing leading questions, I kept saying, was there a spatial, you know,
and it's visual, a visual, and then, I mean, do I actually say, was there a kinesthetic? I mean, it really took some time, and he didn't until I finally said, was there a kinesthetic? I may have said, you made a gesture, but I wasn't sure how to tease that out.
We had the same experience as you saw, that there was Russ had multiple strategies, and one of them was auditory musical based, I guess. I didn't probe that too much, so I don't know if it was auditory, but he mentioned something about how he actually sang when tried to give me an idea of the strategy. And
I say, could you reproduce that?
11, 7, 8.
Yeah, I just find it very similar.
And he also had gestures, as you see.
We're going to perform this later on.
the performance of the Matrix?
Yeah.
Didn't work worth a damn for the second row, by the way.
Second row was a performance. Sorry.
And I also had the same dilemma, because he didn't mention any kinesthetic experience in his recall, but I noticed that he was doing these things and this thing, and so I want. But actually, this thing was during the recording of this script, and I didn't know whether to interview. But I actually said, you know, you're doing a lot of this. Was there any kinesthetic, you know, bodily experience during that? And it was definitely leading him.
Yeah, maybe the case that the kinesthetic strategy is used only for recalling, to place the numbers in the right places.
In a case like that, do you say you did this? Can you talk about it? Do you actually say you were gesturing? Can you talk about that?
Because Ross said to me, when you were describing how you were recalling, you actually had your eyes closed and you were pointing like this.
So I wasn't sure, in terms of procedure, do I actually say, you were pointing, can you talk about that?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah. Okay.
What were you pointing to? Can be precise. You were pointing there. What was that?
Okay.
So there's also kinesthetic activity in the. I mean, you said that Max seemed to have his eyes, he had his eyes closed, and they seemed to be gesturing down to the right, I think he said. Mm. And Jack and I noticed that with Michelle, when he first started, his eyes, he looked at something, then he closed his eyes, and then he looked again and he closed his eyes. And then as he became more confident, he closed his eyes for longer because he was remembering longer patterns or more of it. So I think I take that to be a kinesthetic activity. There are 6 muscles in each eye and they're working very hard. And they're trying to figure out, obviously cognitively as well, you're trying to figure out patterns. Even though you've been told there's no mnemonic, there are actually no mnemonics in there. And Michelle was good at finding them.
and Max just pointed out that it's possible to create a mnemonic.
I found 2 idiosyncratic mnemonics, one for the first line and one for the bottom line, and I was very troubled, which I reported back to Ross, about the fact I couldn't find one for the middle line.
Did you have the same problem?
But you can do them in triangles. What we had with Michelle was very interesting, because he started along the top, and then he went down the right side, and then he went diagonally up, and then he had difficulty with his little corner. He had difficulty with his little corner because he didn't make a pattern, so he made a mental image of that. But the others were a very clear sort of diachronic strategy, and then there was this little pattern for these 3 at the bottom.
Mm-hmm. May I just ask something for all of you that were memorizing? Did you just start it and you knew the technique, or somehow it's not evident that this is? I was, for the first half, 1 minute or something, I had no idea what to do. I was just drifting around.
Well, yes.
Nobody mentioned that. Yeah. I don't.
Well, I'll mention it. Can I say that? Yeah. Michelle had a moment when he looked at, we sat at a table out there, and the paper was on the table, and he looked at it, and and he just shook his head. And I also think that Jack, and he had two people observing him, so he had two sets of eyes on him, and we were watching closely for any movement at all because we didn't know how much we could but then we had to move because you moved on more quickly, and we could hear that Max was already beginning to recall, so we moved to another spot.
Mm-hmm.
And that changed the dynamic of the situation because as we moved, Michelle was able to take the, there was no table, he could put the paper at a longer distance. However, he always, when he did this and sat down again, he went, oh! So,
in answer to Urban's question, I started out with immediately one strategy, but by the time we were done, I had used, I think, five separate strategies,
mm-hmm.
all of which were sort of overlapping.
Mm-hmm. Trashing,
I think
your question
is
also about the anxiety, though.
No, not so much. I didn't feel anxiety. I felt quite comfortable with it.
That's the merits also of the interviewer.
Yeah. but I was just, I had no idea what to do. I was just wanting something to appear.
Oh, okay, I misunderstood you.
I just had no strategy in mind how to approach it.
Have you identified the memorization test at the end? Did you ask the question? Did you know that you knew?
Mm-hmm.
Did you ask this question? And what was the answer? Did you get an answer?
Well, one thing that I thought was
you asked a lot of great questions.
Yes.
As far as I understand it, what happened was you were imagining to be in my position and asking, if I asked him right now, can you recall it? And that kind of reflection, you know, gave a sensation of quite confidence, and that was, so it was kind of a quick rule reversal. If I was asked now to recall, could I do it? And the feeling of confidence that results from that then resulted in saying, yeah, okay, I'm ready.
Yes, but is there a special operation leading to this feeling of confidence? Did you do something?
Yeah, mentally, that's what I said. It's like I imagined somehow, like I had the experience of somebody asking me and then of me answering.
Oh, so you...
Yeah.
Imagine
like,
that.
Yeah, okay, so I did just a little imagination of if I were to be asked at this instant.
Like a rehearsal.
Yeah, like a little rehearsal, silent rehearsal. You know, am I ready? And then it seemed as though I could answer, so I felt ready.
Okay. Yeah. I was, but I realized I was actually going to answer a different question. So
we're good at
it. What I remember you're saying, maybe it's related at least, and I found it interesting, was Michelle talked about the kind of emotional flavor of doing the exercise. And in the beginning there was this kind of panicky quality,
mm-hmm.
and then a kind of relaxation, and then I think that grew until you... And then by the time you were feeling really relaxed with it, then you were done.
Except that even though there was a tentative handing over of the paper
mm-hmm.
and taking back, and then no, okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then one thing we wondered, it's maybe not too important, but when we asked him, actually it was partly the way Susan put the question, she said, can you reconstruct the matrix? So he wanted to write it down, which so he did. But
mm-hmm.
then we thought, well, that gave him another chance to memorize, and, you know, because he had a body sense.
Mm-hmm.
So he wrote it down. But it was very interesting because he wrote it in exactly the order he had memorized, which was very chaotic to my initial view. You know,
an interesting issue came up about the how do you know that you know, or how did you know that you didn't with Russ? Because I think we often, at least I often make the assumption that say they didn't give the last two, they didn't even give a number for the person who had given an answer for the last two, just said, well, 9, and then something else, then I would assume that part of their experience would be that they didn't know what the last two were, so they would know that they didn't know.
No.
But that was wrong in the case of Russ. I was making inductive inferences or whatever. So what seemed clear about his experience was that although it was the case that he didn't give digits for the last two bits, it's not that he knew that he didn't know what the last two digits were, or he didn't he didn't have the experience of not knowing. He didn't have. He just gave this as a response, and he didn't. There wasn't a lot of this metacognition, like knowing that he didn't know, or knowing when he didn't. When did he realize that he didn't know what to say? He just gave this number something else response, and that was the right thing to do. But it wasn't a matter of knowing that it was the. I'm not sure if I'm getting this right, but
I can report on another strategy that was used, which was that even though so you have the page like this. And what happened was that there was an attempt to recall the number, and that kind of placed the number in a kind of imagined grid and fixed it there, and everything else was still a little bit uncertain and fuzzy. Then you would move to the next square and say, can I recall it, and then would fix the number there as well. So there was a kind of overlap between actually having the page here, but also some sort of imaginative construct of painting in the numbers on top of the ones depending on whether you could memorize them. Is that also a strategy used to know whether you have to memorize?
Yeah, well, I use that, and also I try to construct a rule similar to what other people were saying, where I try to pick the four corners and find a rule that would let me get from corner to corner through the diagonal. You know, so we have 21 and 8 and 9 on two corners. Just those types of ways to be, but then in addition to that, then I wanted to go over and sort of as you said, auditory. I spoke it out loud to myself, mentally, and tried to imagine really anchoring it. So I was trying to get sort of really a visual lock on it. But all of those, I guess, in terms of your knowing that you know, I just wanted to add a little bit of what I said earlier. I did that imagined interview, but I still didn't feel 100% confident. So. In some ways, I felt I'm for the point of this exercise, we'll keep going. But I felt I did have a feeling of not being, completely certain, but certain enough to at least make a pretty good stab at it, or something, right? So.
So we should probably wind up.
Yeah. May I just ask a question? I would like to know if you, as interviewee, have learned, have the feeling to have. Learn something about pre-reflective process. Through did the interview help you to become aware of some pre-reflective process which qui serait resté pré-réfléchi sans l'interview.
Would have had stayed pre-reflexive.
Would have remained pre-reflexive.
Yes.
Yeah.
That the interview.
I think you notice it when the interviewee says, "Aha, now actually, there was something there." So there's almost a moment of surprise, of "Oh, now I remember something more," and you can notice it in the voice in the.
Yes, exactly. In the course of the interview, there is something more emerging.
I remember you saying specifically at one point, said, "Oh, I didn't remember before, but now I remember I did this."
I was actually pretty in touch with what I was doing, because I think I actually mess around with numbers in my head anyway. It's just something I do.
Except for the kids, that didn't
have
that.
Yeah. I didn't have very much. I didn't have very much of that, and I didn't. Did I have very much? I didn't have something. Well, when I was pointing, yeah, but that was more in the recall. But in the memorization, I was pretty well. In fact, as I was doing it, I thought, "Oh yeah, what I'm doing is pretty familiar. I'm singing it to myself and trying to lay down a kind of recording track and trying to find associations."
Okay.
This is all fairly standing stuff.